Mondays and Fridays. There'll be a caravan going up to San Francisco at noon on Thursday, May 16th, leaving from 809 Center Street, City Hall, in case you wish to come along. Hopefully there'll be room, or wish to donate your own vehicle, because we need vehicles to go up there. The issue, again, is the right to share free food. I was convicted in 1994 of serving free food in violation of a court injunction against Food Not Bombs, and we'll be going up to San Francisco in search of a sentence modification from the original judge who sentenced me to 2 months in jail. I've exhausted all my other appeals. Yes, 72 days ago. That sleepout has been going for over 2 months. Its objective, of course, to end the city's sleeping ban. And the guitarist has a good style and a good voice. The rest of us, of course, sound like a drunken lout, or a lot of louts and so forth. But it's still happening at City Hall at 809 Center Street. So I encourage you to go on down there, day or night, and support those folks with coffee, with blankets, with just encouraging words. They're also trying to do outreach to other groups and other people. And there's talk of doing a march up to San Francisco. At least I'm talking about it. Of course, I may be doing more marching back and forth from the exercise yard to the commissary to my cell. But we'll see what goes on. First interview you're going to hear is with David Dumars, also known as BD. David, I actually describe in detail at the beginning of the interview so you can get a sense of what's happening. I've known him, gosh, I don't know how long, 3 years, 4 years, something like that. Anyway, here's David Dumars and I at the Coffee Roasting Company about a month and a half ago.
I'm in the Coffee Roasting Company with that notorious activist who's now doing community service on the weekends or some such thing for his...
No, it's not community service. It's work release.
Oh, work release. I see. Well, what is the difference between... Well, before we go any further, we're talking to BD, also known as L.A. Dave, or David Dumars, an organizer for Refuse and Resist, who refused and resisted at one point back in... Very nice. He's showing me a counterattack here. There's a publication by Refuse and Resist. We're sitting in the Coffee Roasting Company, which of course needs no further explanation. It was the scene of your pepper gassing, your second pepper gassing in 2 days in 1994, for essentially speaking up about a vigil that the police were harassing and attempting to disband across the streets for homeless rights. And you recently, I guess it was April 1st, you went to court thereabouts, and you got sentenced to some preposterous sentence for vandalism for writing the New World Order as a Third Reich odor on a newspaper box, a Sentinel box of all things. That's the Santa Cruz County Sentinel. And you're now doing work release around that. Is that correct?
report?
No, the work release is not scheduled to start till the 1st of May, May Day.
May Day.
What,
do you have a special work release program for May Day? You're going to be doing picketing as you release yourself, or what's happening?
We'll figure something out, but...
Appeal.
You are going to appeal it.
Oh, absolutely.
And who's the attorney who's taking that appeal?
I don't know yet.
Junk Ed Fry.
I don't know if he wants to do it. You know, I mean, I don't know if his heart's in it and stuff. There is a question of when you work with lawyers, getting people who like really, you know, really want to take it on.
Right. Have you found a refuse and resist attorney flown in from New York City to assist you?
No, that would be from Moscow.
Oh, from Moscow?
No,
probably Beijing now. Right?
Beijing, yes.
Deep in the forests of Peru with the Sendero Luminoso and their special English-speaking attorney.
It's kind of difficult. I don't think most of the people in Peru speak English. I think they speak like Quechua or some indigenous language.
Later, we aren't bigoted.
Hey, I'm for it.
We say Merry Christmas in Quechua.
I have no idea. I don't speak Quechua.
I'm gonna get up there, David or BD as you prefer. What's happening in Santa Cruz in the next month, either around Refuse and Resist or other stuff that might be of interest to our radio listeners on civil rights for the poor issues that you think we could become aware of that we don't already know about?
Well, there's going to be a forum which you are going to be a part of. I think that people should attend that. You know, from our perspective, from Refuse and Resist, the video that was taken of the attack by police on me is going to be shown there, or parts of it, I think.
This is back in February of 1994.
Right.
And this actual showing and the forum is going to be on April 24th at 7:30. Is it at Loudon Nelson or is it 7? Is it 7 or 7:30?
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And
the forum run by the Revolutionary Coalition, supported by Huff and I guess the Common Thread Coalition, Dan Hopkins' group at City Hall,
actually came off very well. And there's another forum coming up on May 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at Loudon Nelson Center. Again, the subjects have to do with the rights of the poor in Santa Cruz, the progress of the sleep out at City Hall, and new strategies we're going to be following. And for those who want information on that, you can give a call to... at 421-9250, 421-9250.
It would have been very difficult to prove that it was attempted murder, is what Powell was trying to do. But to not have convicted him on excessive force is so incredibly stupid. I don't even know how to fathom it, except from the black man's perspective and the Hispanic inner city, the poor people's perspective. Wake up, America. It's happened all the time. It's been going on for decades. That was just the first one we caught on film, and they got off.
It's not even the first one on film, as a matter of fact.
No, actually, as a matter of fact, it's not even the first one.
Hello?
Hello. You hear me?
You're on the air, yes.
Yeah, nine lines, huh? I've been to tons of your lectures, Craig, and Roy, we've spoken several times in person. Real quick, I wanted to pass this along. The Midnight Special Bookstore is having a week of discussion forums for the rest of the week. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the topic is going to be State of Speech. Speakers are Thelma Rios from the Alliance of Native Americans and Teresa Allison from the Henry Pico Justice Committee. Thursday is Media Distortion of an L.A. Crisis with speakers from FAIR and other organizations concerned with media censorship.
Cast this! Spider crew! Give it up!
Yeah, George Bush is a real fan of funding eugenics and that those kinds of things. Lobotomies, by the way, are coming back in a big way.
Yeah, there's a term here. What do they call it? Psychosurgery.
Yes. Yeah, they're gonna keep this from ever happening again. What just took place in L.A. See, they proposed during the '60s to give massive suborbital lobotomies to all the blacks that were riding in Detroit and Watts, etc. That was proposed. I have it in the congressional record. And the only reason it was stopped by one wild libertarian named Thomas Sace from the psychiatric community. He exposed it. And really made a one-man assault on the notion of doing such a thing. but they continued doing lobotomies for years. They were performing over 50 a year on different people in this country, and they're still doing them, only not to that degree. But it is coming back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's very interesting, because I have to tell you, I'm involved in, I'm a music technologist, so I do systems for musicians, and most of our clients are like a lot of major performers, and it's interesting to me, being a black man, to have to deal with some clients, and when they actually meet me, I've had people actually ask me to my face, where'd you learn how to do this? Like, they want to go after the person that, you know, school has 2 degrees. I'm supposed to know what I'm doing, but for some reason, it's unfathomable to them that I can comprehend things like software design, microprocessors. You know, it's sort of a thing that I'm not supposed to know how to do it because my brain
isn't. You know how to read, right?
With Jody Foster and Harvey Keitel. Looks like I'm walking through a living hell. So spark that L and I'll get lifted. Feeling the effects of what must flipped it. Cause I'm gifted. I read Sun Tzu. I brought a gun too, so you'll never come to. The weight of the world riding on my shoulders. Cause I'm a soldier. I thought I told you. You're just another victim. You're just another victim, kid. You're just another victim.
Keith McHenry, Who Not Bombs Activist, who is based in San Francisco.
Right.
Is going to be at the Refuse and Resist conference in New York City. He's going to be awarded a Courageous Resistor Award. What about that famous political prisoner, Robert Norris, who goes to hearing on May 3rd for serving free food and faces two months in jail?
Right.
Well, see, I think that the thing about the Courageous Resistor Award isn't so much that other people don't do it. I think we know that other people do it. I know.
Because I've already won the Most Irritating Man in Santa Cruz Award that you're passing me over. Is that right?
No. They actually passed me over also.
Oh,
you know.
Fine.
I know. I'm crying buckets of tears, you know.
Right. Well, the two of us could form our own dissident faction of Refuse and Resist.
That's it. Dissident factions.
Yes.
Yeah. Wouldn't do us a whole lot of good. That's a lot of what Refuse and Resist is anyway. But, you know, we could do it.
They
could
do it.
Anyway.
When is the next meeting of Refuse and Resist for those who wish to join in?
It won't be till after the conference.
When is the conference?
26th, 27th, 28th.
Of April. So for all those who want, just jump in your cars or stick out your thumbs and head for New York City, right?
Well, one thing is that people should like tune in and find out what did go on. For example, one of the individuals that's going to be at the conference is this woman, Mae Johnson. She's a black woman from Chicago. And in Chicago, like other cities, they're destroying low-income housing, which I guess is directly relevant to the issue of homelessness.
Sure, they destroyed the low-income campground here in December, and we have the city's sleeping ban, so we have a criminal status for everybody who's poor outside. Is there a possibility, do you do other radio shows that mention Refuse and Resist updates? Have you done anything recently in the last week or two?
No, I haven't done anything recently.
Because I think that you might want to get an hour on the air to just do an update on what's happening with, well, your own perception of events around Santa Cruz, I know you have a perspective on international politics, which isn't shared by everyone in town, or even every radical in town.
It's quite controversial. I love it. It's great. Controversy is a great thing.
And so I think maybe you might want to get a radio show, or at least perhaps send in a tape, do a kind of a weekly half-hour tape or more on sort of updating people. For instance, the highlights of this conference is coming up, could be broadcast on the internet, and we could rebroadcast them on Free Radio Santa Cruz, assuming we are broadcasting, because as you know, Claudia Wilkins will come up with a decision for Free Radio Berkeley in the very near future, which may impact us, well, which will impact us directly.
It'll impact Santa Cruz one way or another,
yes.
Period. It will. Whatever the decision is. Hopefully, I'm very hopeful that that there'll be some backing off, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, I it's hard for me to tell, being somewhat of a distant observer on that affair.
Your case is being appealed, you say, but you don't have an attorney, so there's no date. You can appeal at any time in the next few months, or when's your deadline?
Okay, what the situation with an appeal is that you file basically a one-page document stating the
grounds of the appeal.
And you don't even have to be particularly in-depth.
just this, right? Very, very short. And then you have X amount of time, months, to file a written brief. The prosecutor then has essentially the same period of time to write a response.
Now, you are going to be appealing a work release sentence that will already be completed by the time the appeal gets through, right?
No, the sentence gets stayed.
I see. So you won't be doing your work release.
Hey, I say, don't go down quietly.
So you are pretty determined to appeal then?
Oh, absolutely. We're definitely going to appeal it.
So do you have the legal force, we at the Sleep Out at Vigil, I should say, they at the Sleep Out Vigil, and those of us who support them, and I'm not there much, but except as a sort of a flyer writer, have had a lot of trouble finding legal support. Have you had any similar difficulties?
I tend not to have a whole lot of difficulties finding legal support.
You pay for it with hard currency, or you simply give them a winning smile, or invite them to, should we say, visit your headquarters in the Peruvian jungles? Just kidding about the headquarters.
We promised them high position in the new regime, and they say, oh goody, that's what I want.
You promised that Sendero Luminoso assassination squads will not, at least in the first cut, do the triage that, should we say, ends their part of the ruling class complicity.
No. The Sendero works very very diligently with lawyers. In fact, it's very necessary in their particular circumstances. As serious as they are about going after you, Robert, and me, they are more serious about going after Sendero.
How is Mr. Guzman doing these days?
I don't know. He is still in solitary confinement. He still is. Well, in any case, that's a personal thing. I mean, that's my personal take, because Refuse and Resist does not deal with, foreign policy issues, basically.
Refuse and Resist is an organization that's how old?
Nine years old.
And how long have you been associated with it?
Five.
And before you were with Refuse and Resist, were there other groups that you were working with?
Yeah. I mean,
what were those groups?
Well, one of the groups that I was working with was a group called the Unemployed Workers Organizing Committee, but this was back in the 70s, okay? Other groups that I've worked with a number of groups. I worked with a bookstore, particular bookstore called Left Hand Books, right, which is kind of a radical
Los
bookstore.
Angeles bookstore?
No, actually in Colorado. So, I mean, I'm a product of the 60s, right? I'm not...
Not a product of the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s.
Well, in a certain sense, yeah, but I'm not 18. Can I fool you into this? Well, how about 29?
You don't look as young as you might, but you have a very beaming and winning smile, I've got to say that.
Yeah.
And also, apparently, a working watch. Are you hurried for time?
Yeah, I'm going to be splitting here pretty quick. But
tell us...
What I'd like to say is what we are going to do nationally, locally, I'd like to say two things. One is, in the immediate future, we're going to do a forum on the threat to fascism and kind of a reflection back on the Weimar Republic and what did develop in Germany.
Because the Republic in Germany immediately before the Nazi takeover.
Right.
I'm going to interrupt you briefly to ask, because the first comment you made to me this morning had to do with a counterterrorism bill. Would you like to sum up for the folks those little known aspects of the national counterterrorism bill, which is due to pass by Friday in honor of the Oklahoma City bombing, with both Clinton and Dole marching in unison to the same perverted drummer? Can you give us a sense of what the terrorism bill holds in store for us? I know it talks about these essentially limiting habeas corpus appeals to one in the capital cases, or maybe even in any case. I'm not quite sure about that. And I know it has some reference to tagging explosives and so forth, which actually probably is rather non-controversial. But what, in your mind, are the most draconian provisions of this counterterrorism bill?
Well, first, kind of the main thrust of the counterterrorism bill is to go after immigrants, is to separate off people who live in this country, quote-unquote natives, people who are born here, citizens, from people who are in this country from around the world, and also from people who are still in other parts of the world. And And that's kind of the main thrust of what they're trying to do. What they have in the bill is the ability for influential members in the executive branch of, or other branches also, but high in the government, to designate as terrorists basically any group for a variety of reasons. This is not subject to judicial review. This is simply, it does not require an arrest, does not require a conviction. This is simply a designation that such and such a group is terrorist.
So in essence, Food Not Bombs, or Refuse and Resist, or HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, could be designated as a terrorist group, and there will be no judicial review of this status?
None whatsoever, and yeah, that's true. Not only are the groups to be designated as being terrorist, that then precludes any kind of support activity. For example, if Food Not Bombs was designated as terrorist because somebody in Food Not Bombs, not me, for sure, not me, went and spray painted on the side of a, say, highway.
Right. Or perhaps a newspaper box.
Or perhaps a newspaper box. Something to the effect of, you know, feed the people, you know, don't shoot the people, or something to that effect. You know, whatever, in the spirit of what Food Not Bombs does. Clearly a terrorist activity, and they were designated by the government as being terrorists. Then contributing to Food Not Bombs then becomes also criminal activity. In other words, if you give food to Food Not Bombs, then you are accomplice in the terrorist activity. Now what happens is that if you are designated to be a terrorist organization, they can come in, the FBI, and what they're doing with this is that they are accentuating the power, specifically the federal law enforcement, okay, which of course will filter down. But nevertheless, the point is that what they're doing is that they're unleashing all kinds of new ways to have wiretaps. We know, of course, based on their history, they would never use that on a group like Refuse and Resist or Food Not Bombs or HUF, you know. I mean, we're on such friendly terms with the FBI, you know, and they would never use that for us.
Certainly a sarcastic comment on your part.
Yeah. Anyway.
Now, wasn't that provision, in fact, removed from the bill at the behest of the American Rifle Association? That, in fact, was the legal tender for their support. That's what I read in the, I guess it was yesterday's Chronicle or yesterday's Mercury. Today's Mercury News, I believe it was, stated that initially this bill got stalled in the House of Representatives at the national level because the American Rifle Association and the American Civil Liberties Union teamed up to say no way, and they had the right-wingers and the liberals saying, forget it, Clinton, you may want this for your birthday, but you're going to have to wait. And now, however, what's happened is the American Rifle Association has gotten that. For some reason, they don't want the wiretap provision. Maybe they're afraid of, I don't know, the Aryan Nation being wiretapped or something.
I don't think that the Aryan Nation wants to be wiretapped.
Nor do I, for that matter.
Right.
So we have something in common.
I won't comment on that either, but...
I have a copy of Mein Kampf.
Okay. But anyway,
just kidding about that, folks. I would never have such a banned book.
I think people should read it, actually. People should take a very serious look at what the Nazis were really
all
about.
Hitler's speeches are more interesting than his book Mein Kampf, in my opinion, but who am I to second-guess the Führer?
Yeah. Anyway...
His birthday, by the way, is April 20th, in case you wanted to have some sort of celebration.
Well, what, by burning American flags or something? I don't know.
Perhaps you could burn an American flag, a Weimar flag.
Robert Norris report, of course, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, the weekend edition, the special weekend edition. Of course, he's going to have another tape for tomorrow. we'll be playing it here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Yes, we'll play anything. Send us shit. P.O. Box 7652, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Free Radio Santa Cruz. P.O. Box 7652, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Send us some PSAs. Send us some money for the phone bill and things. Maybe we can get a record player now. You know, who knows? Well, we're going to get a phone in here soon. Stay tuned. It's coming through. Really, it is. This is 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. We don't think here.
Your friend Uncle Phil here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. It is 9:59 according to the clock in the station, and that is time for the Bathrobes Pierres Broadsides show. I know, kids, I know you can feel the tension in the air. I know you're getting all a flutter, but I gotta stop that fucking PSA tape that's running again. This is 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz. Yeah, no shit, right?
And that was Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger singing Black and White, a song from the mid-80s, from their album White Wind, Black Tide. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pier Robert Norris, and for the next 2 hours, you'll be listening to Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides. Normally, we're a pretty freewheeling show with lots of call-ins, numerous walk-ins, a few crawl-ins, and hey, we've even considered a sleep-in here. But the studio is still in the process of transition from moving from one location to another. So this is a tape, and you won't be able to call in because the phone line isn't hooked up yet, and I'm not in the studio. But if you have something to say about something you hear here, or you have something you want to say about something you haven't heard here regarding the rights of poor people, oppressive laws here in Santa Cruz and elsewhere, you can still be on the air. All you have to do is give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's HUFF headquarters, and HUFF, of course, is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a group concerned with decriminalizing poverty and with pressing the rights of poor people to use of public accommodations, right to sleep, right to be free from discrimination in different arenas, and so forth. This is also going to be my last tape before my May 16th hearing in San Francisco, where I will be facing a 2-month jail sentence given me by Judge Robert Barkley in February of 1994 for the crime of serving free food with Food Not Bombs in violation of a court order. I have hope that Barclay will see reason when presented with a plea from the San Francisco District Attorney Terrence Hallinan to reduce this 2-month jail sentence to time served, which means I will simply walk away from it with the 1 day in jail that I did serve covering for the entire jail sentence. I have hope, but frankly, I'm preparing to go to jail, and I suspect that that's what's going to happen, because Barclay, from what I've seen at the trial, is a pretty tough customer. He refused to allow my main witness to testify. He held
that was
Food Not Bombs activist Keith McHenry. I call him Katzenjammer Keith. You've heard him on this station giving interviews and updating us on what's going on in San Francisco. In fact, this morning we may have another interview. Barclay is also, he refused to allow the jury to hear various defenses. He tried to stop us from using the word homeless in the voir dire, the process of choosing the jury. And I just get the impression he's a very conservative man from a very conservative county, which is beyond San Francisco, far beyond it. Local San Francisco judges didn't want this case, and they kicked it into his court, and that's what happened again this time, this May, when we originally had a hearing before Judge Tang, and that was scheduled for May 3rd, as you regular listeners know. Anyway, their caravan for this event, should you be interested in coming along and sharing bagels and showing your support, leaves from City Hall, 809 Center Street, the site of the City Hall sleepout, now in its 75th day, at noon on Thursday, May 16th. So if you have a vehicle or you want to come along yourself, just come on down to City Hall. If you want to let me know about this, if you think you are going, give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. The first interview you're going to hear is one involving Bobby Joyce. Bobby was the lead plaintiff in the Matrix lawsuit filed in the city of San Francisco to stop the harassment of homeless people under Mayor Juggernaut Jordan. Harassment, incidentally, that we learned from Bobby, continues. This interview is on May 3rd. Bobby now works for the Coalition on Homelessness, one of the main fighters up in San Francisco. They already published the street sheet. They threw the demonstration May 8th to force Willie Brown to face the fact that his administration is giving out more sleeping tickets than Mayor Jordan's was. This in spite of a promise that he was going to stop all this stuff, and in spite of the fact that his district attorney has dropped over 38,000 citations for these kinds of victimless crimes designed essentially to run homeless people out of town and out of sight in, I guess, April. Terrence Hallinan, the district attorney, dropped all those charges. So let's hear this interview.
It's May 3rd, 1996.
Okay, I'm on the line with Bobby Joyce of the Coalition on Homelessness. Hi, Bobby.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, how's everything at the office up there?
Things are pretty hectic.
Really? Why is that?
A lot of stuff going on. Still trying to figure out the end of Matrix, supposedly.
The fabled end of Matrix, which still seems to become something of a fable, huh?
Yeah, still going on. Well, we just got 39,000 tickets dismissed through the help of our staff attorney, Judith Appel.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty excited about that.
We read about that down here, and we liked it. The question, of course, is, are these tickets that have to do with the Brown administration? I'm not the Brown administration. Yeah, well, actually, do they? Are they just the Jordan administration?
It was through, actually, some of them were through Brown, because he took office in January 8th,
mm-hmm.
and these tickets were dismissed from, like, August 1st of 93 through February 22nd of 96, so a couple of them were his.
So, actually, February 22nd is also a crucial date, because I believe that's the date when Brown made the statement, there will be no further arrests for sleeping.
Yeah.
A statement that so far has been something of a lie, right?
Yeah, it has been. So people, matter of fact, camping and sleeping, the tickets have gone up. We're getting people receiving anywhere from like 1,200 to the top number would be like 1,500 tickets a month.
And this is going on throughout March and April as well as January and February?
Right.
What's the perception of people on the streets? Does it seem like the crackdown is continuing? Does it seem like it's abated at all? What about the park, Golden Gate Park?
The police are still out there. It's still going on. You know, there's nothing has changed. His statement is that Matrix is over. That doesn't mean anything because people are still getting tickets. People are still being harassed. And, you know, it's the same old thing.
Now, what about the statement Judy made yesterday in the San Francisco Examiner, which said something to the effect of, I guess that there was a statement before the police commission about increased police patrols, I believe it was.
Yeah, well, since he's been in office, they have what they call a fat day, and which is from Commander Holder told us is that there's been like 250 additional police officers that have been out on the streets and in San Francisco since the Brown administration,
mm-hmm.
and they've just been like doing their job, I guess.
And their job is to do a job on the homeless, huh?
Exactly. Supposedly, what they told us is that Matrix is over with, because they used to have like 150 police officers directed mainly going out and citing and arresting homeless people for committing the quality of crisis under the Jordan administration.
Right.
But now that Brown has taken office, he says that Matrix is over. But if a police officer sees somebody committing a crime, then they have to act on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, like sleeping, let's say.
Right. Yeah. You're committing a crime because you're sleeping.
But in fact, do you feel that the police are still actively looking for homeless people to harass in the parks and the downtown areas?
As far as we're concerned, they are.
So you're attending some kind of a protest on May 8th.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, where it is, when it is, who's going to be involved, and what you're trying to get.
Basically, we're just trying to let people know what's still going on. Matrix is still happening. People's rights are still being violated. And, you know, to end this thing, it's going to take a collaboration of a lot of folks, a lot of hard work and effort. And it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out Superman fight.
So when is this demonstration happening, and what can people do? What can they bring to it? What's your suggestion?
They can just, you know, show their support. That's what we need, like, you know, people's support and to understand, you know, the plight that homeless people are going through.
Where is this going to be, this demo?
It's going to be over on Van Ness in the new City Hall building.
And what's the address there?
Hold on. Let me see if I can get there, because I'm not for sure myself.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Bobby, who's also a plaintiff in the case filed against Matrix by a number of poor people. Go ahead.
It's 401 Van Ness on the corner of McAllister and Van Ness.
401 Van Ness, and that will be Wednesday, May 8th?
Right.
At what time?
12 o'clock, I think.
And will Food Not Bombs be serving food?
I'm not for sure if they'll be there. More likely they will be.
Mm-hmm. I understand Food Not Bombs has not been suffering harassment under the Brown administration. Is that true?
Well, somewhat. You know, a lot of times some police officers are sympathetic and they will let, you know, Food Not Bombs serve food. And then you have officers that say that they're doing their job.
Have you actually heard of people getting citations in the Food Not Bombs group?
Not
since
lately.
Yeah, I hadn't either. I heard there was a brief harassment incident mission in 16th in mid-March, but and some threats, but that there actually been no tickets given. And I hear the defendant, who is now going to be going to jail for 2 months for serving free food back in 1993, Robert Norse Kahn, he's facing what's called a sentence modification hearing. It was scheduled for today, but it's been postponed until it's either the 8th or the 16th, depending on when the district attorney, Terrence Hallinan, has time to appear in court. He's hoping to have that sentence reduced from 2 months to nothing, and since Hallinan is the primary, you know, is a big man in the Brown administration, or at least in the San Francisco City justice machine, or injustice machine, you know, hopefully that'll happen. That's me, by the way. I'm Robert Norse Kahn.
All right.
I'm also reporting here on this for Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have a show twice a week from 10 to 12 called Bathrobe Spears Broadsides on 96.3 FM down here, and then we send the tapes north to San Francisco, some of them, so they get rebroadcast on Liberation Radio.
Right.
Now, you were a plaintiff in the Joyce suit, right, against the Matrix program.
I am the lead plaintiff in the Matrix lawsuit.
So what happened to you that made you this plaintiff, and what's been happening to you recently, and where is this suit at the moment?
Well, I was cited for sleeping in Civic Center Park back in October of 93 when I became homeless when I was on GA. I missed one of my workfare days, and I was told that my GA workfare was discontinued, and I came to find out that it hadn't been discontinued, and basically I had been homeless for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the coalition seeking legal help, and I got legal help. And when I came back and started volunteering, because I was appreciated for what they had done for me, the lawsuit was just coming into play, and they were trying to get people to do declarations. And they hadn't decided on any of the plaintiffs yet.
This was a lawsuit seeking an injunction against enforcement of laws that make it criminal to be poor in a public space, right?
And they actually took me a couple times to think about, because I had said no, because our lives were, like, exposed completely to everyone, basically, throughout the United States and some parts of the free world.
But you had many women asking to marry you, right?
No, I didn't. And I thought about it.
And a number of men, too.
I thought about it. They said that, you know, they needed somebody to speak up about what was happening to homeless people in San Francisco. And they had chosen, like, four of us to be the spokespeople, and they chose me to be, like, the lead plaintiff. I don't know actually why, but somehow I accepted the responsibility of doing that.
Now, Judge Jensen, a reactionary judge who is, I believe, a prosecutor in the Nixon administration, who is now a reactionary judge in the Clinton administration, I suppose, it actually is in the court system, ruled against you, and the case is now on appeal.
Yes.
Ruled that it's apparently fine to make it criminal, essential to life activities by poor people in public spaces. Any predictions on how that's going to go, and any court dates that people should know about?
Well, as far as Jensen was concerned, he felt that the city should, first of all, that the lawsuit never should have been in court. He felt that he had read a memorandum where the police department had sent out saying that they would do sensitivity training with their officers concerning homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And when he seen this memorandum, he felt that, well, the city can handle its own problems. So that was it. He never read any of the declarations, none of the statements or anything. So
this is the federal judge who ruled on the case.
Right. So when he gave the city their preliminary and injunction, I mean, the legal term, but he decided with them, so we had to appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court. And hopefully the judges up there will be able to read the material that was submitted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, read the declarations, understand what's going on, the suffering the homeless people are being subject to.
Are we approaching a court date on this, or?
It's in June sometime. I'm not exactly when.
Now, you're seeking financial damages as well as an injunction?
Actually, the only thing I'm seeking for is the stop harassment of homeless people. That's the only thing I'm looking for. I'm not looking for any money, any publicity, or anything. That's the only thing I want out of all of this is the fact that if a homeless person cannot afford to live in a house, or he doesn't have any money, or if they can't access the shelters that are available to them because of
the number of homeless people versus the number of shelter beds, which is like 1,200 shelter beds on any given day.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like 11,000 to 15,000 homeless people here in San Francisco on any given day. And if they have to sleep outside, that they will not be ticketed.
Now, I'm wondering about the extent of the contacts of the coalition with other organizations supporting the rights of poor and homeless people throughout the country. There have been demonstrations in some cities, for instance here in Santa Cruz, where on the 65th day of a sleep out at City Hall against the city's sleeping ordinance, which makes it illegal for people to be asleep after 11 o'clock at night anywhere in public spaces, with a very few exceptions that don't in any way deal with the 500 to 1,500 homeless people in our area, in the city area. And also makes it illegal to cover up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night. Now, demonstrations in Santa Barbara and the threat of a mass migration in 1986 by then national activist Mitch Snyder produced a change in their sleeping ban, which redefined the law to make it a true camping ban so that you couldn't camp with a tent, but you could sleep and have a blanket, let's say. San Francisco is, what's the situation in San Francisco with respect to that? Do you think direct action protests would be helpful in San Francisco and in Santa Cruz? And is there any chance of support between the cities? Think about that for a moment while I get this other call.
Okay.
That's on that.
Well, I'm not sure about, as far as the coalition, the support that we can give Santa Cruz. I haven't heard any. In your street sheet, I think it was either the March or the February issue, maybe the April issue, about by a woman named Becky Johnson, who's our press, does press releases down here for three groups supporting the coalition, supporting the sleep out, a group called the Revolutionary Coalition, my group, Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and then the group that closely connected with the actual sleep out itself called the Common Thread Coalition. And she had an article on your street sheet. We're wondering if you can bring it up at one of your COH meetings.
Sure, I can do that. like I said, I haven't heard anything, but, you know, it's so much stuff going on, not just with the Matrix thing, but Guru is busy with challenging Department of Social Services and how the treatment of people when they go to get on general assistance.
Any other specific causes that you guys are pursuing right now that might be of interest to our listeners here?
Other than, like, the Contract on America that our Family Rights and Dignity person, Malika, is working with.
What about the Presidio takeover that we heard? There was a demonstration, I guess, last weekend with Terry Messman and the Religious Witness Group.
I don't know. Well,
I haven't heard about that. Okay.
No, I haven't. We have an organization called TIDA that's like working on housing out on the studio.
What's it called?
It's TIDA. I'm not the acronym of what it stands for.
Now, what about the Homes Not Jails? Are you connected with them?
Homes Not Jails is still in action. Not a lot. The office actually closed here in San Francisco.
Ah, that's too bad.
They have a national office in Oakland, but they don't have it here in San Francisco.
And do you have any connections with the National Union of the Homeless?
Not that I know of.
Okay, and are you planning anything this summer at the Atlanta Olympics, where we understand homeless people are being systematically driven out of town, new laws are being passed, landscaping is being designed to make it, you know, very difficult to be homeless in places where it was okay to be homeless before, and so forth?
We have this gentleman by the name of Chris Daly that was considering on doing some actions on the torch thing that's going on today. But other than that, I'm not for sure what's going on with that. It's pretty unfortunate that a city will take itself and just, you know, demolish people's campsites from where they're living at when they have nowhere else to go because of a convention or the Olympics or whatever. You know, it's pretty sad.
It is.
One human being has to treat another human being like this.
Yeah. There's also, of course, a new series of anti-homeless laws in the smaller cities in the South Bay, such as, I guess I recently was at the Stanford Housing Action Coalition convention or meeting, which they talked about how in Palo Alto, homeless people actually prevented the city council from passing a new so-called aggressive panhandling law by getting lots of people there, which I found revolutionary, because here at Santa Cruz, it seems when we tried to stop them from passing their anti-homeless downtown ordinances, we failed, although we got many, many people, and there was an overwhelming opposition to those ordinances from those who were in the chambers, nonetheless. Well, certainly there was a significant opposition, let's put it that way. I don't know if it was overwhelming, but
apparently it can be done in some of the community, in the smaller communities, and I wonder if you've been staying in touch with those communities and offering your support as a Coalition on Homelessness when these laws come up.
Well, we always offer our support to anybody, you know, who calls and asks for our support, information.
Excellent. Send me a copy of the May street sheet.
I will.
Let me give you the address.
Okay, hold on.
You are Bobby Joyce, so let's get that clear. This is not Jones, James, or Jeans. This is Bobby Joyce. He is the Joyce. All right, well, listen, I'm glad that you and others undertook this suit. I hope you are successful, and I'd like to get more updates. Feel free to give us a call, Bobby.
I thank you for your support and for your listeners to hear me out.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Bobby Joyce of the Coalition on Homelessness, lead plaintiff in the in the Natrix case. The decision by Judge Jensen refusing to respect the rights of homeless people in San Francisco is actually called the Joyce decision after Bobby Joyce. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is a recorded tape on May 13th, 1996. We are playing for you some interviews that have not yet been aired. Indeed, we've been trying to play interviews at other times as well, since I have many hours of tape that I think would be of interest to folks who are following these homeless issues, these issues of civil rights for people without roofs, people who live outside, and people who simply want there to be a society where all kinds of people are tolerated and no one is excluded and respected, not just tolerated, respected. There actually is going to be a demonstration coming up, which folks might be interested in knowing about. On May 31st, there will be a huge circus at the county courthouse, a 10 o'clock mass arraignment of folks arrested under the city sleeping ban and the City Hall sleep-out protests. Again, a protest that's been going on for 75 days, starting on March 1st. To get the day of the protest that we're on now, you simply add 62 to the current date. Today is the 13th, 62 and 13 make 75. This is day 75, and tonight will be night 75. So anyway, on May 31st, there's going to be a demonstration at 9 o'clock in front of the county building to drum up public support for and press information onto the public regarding this ridiculous, costly waste of money that the city is forcing us all to undergo rather than re-examine its anti-homeless law, the city sleeping ban, Municipal Code 6.36.010. So you're invited to come to that. If you want more information about that, give a call to the Common Thread Coalition at 421-9250. That's the Common Thread Coalition, 421-9250. As I said before, I may not be with you for these next 2 months because of this jail sentence. You can still leave a message on my line, 423-4833, and those messages will be picked up. And hopefully, if you have a long message, for instance, about an upcoming event or simply a statement of information, a report about police abuse, something else you think is of public interest, we'll put that on the air. Beggarbacker Becky Johnson is going to be on the air covering my show during the time I'm in jail, and no doubt there'll be a number of other guest hosts taking up the slack. And again, there's the possibility that I may not go to jail after all. We'll see what happens on Thursday, May 16th. But in the event that I do, don't fail to keep calling in with reports that will inform the community and stop the institutionalized abuse that's happening every night under the city's sleeping ban and the kind of easy discrimination that's going to be going down, particularly as we see the new construction in the Swenson-purchased former Ford's parking lot area, which is right at Cathcart and Pacific at Friendship Corner, or Hippie Corner as some call it. There's a new fence up there. Things are beginning to look like the construction is underway, and the sitting ban will come into play. Speaking of which, I went to the 7-Eleven last night buying some coffee for the folks at the sleepout on Sunday night, May 12th, and ran into a tall fellow employed there who told me that he had been approached by a police officer under the sitting ban for sitting down near Anibus Warpus, the former Anibus Warpus store up on Pacific Avenue. He expressed his disgust and his outrage at the issue, but I guess the point is that folks are being harassed on Pacific Avenue. And indeed, there are, interestingly enough, claims were made by Mayor Rotkin. You'll see a long letter of Mayor Rotkin's if you read this week's City on a Hill newspaper in the letters section.
attacking me personally and defending the city's sleeping ban and so forth. And it's called Mayor Rotkin Responds and takes up a whole column and a half, about the same amount of space, somewhat longer than the letter that I wrote 2 weeks before. And one of Rotkin's claims, not actually mentioned in this letter, but which he repeats, is that blankets, when they were stolen from protesters, were only done so because they were to protest and they had an interest in having their blankets stolen, or they put themselves in the line of fire, or they shouldn't whimper and wail because, after all, they wanted to make a point in court. Of course, this is a ridiculous argument. The protesters want their rights respected just like any other person in Santa Cruz, and what they're trying to do is put the spotlight on police abuses and institutional city abuses if they occur, which they do. And for Rotkin to justify those abuses by saying that he's helping out the protesters with that kind of thing is ridiculous. That's all I can say about that. Now, recently, as you may know, blankets have not been taken from the vigil due to pressure by Celia Scott, well, due to pressure by Dan Hopkins, Sean Alimi, Pat Ring, and other protesters, and finally picked up by council members Byers and Scott, who then got the city attorney and the city manager involved, and the city attorney attempted to duck the issue, saying, well, blankets are just, they don't have to take the blankets, but they can as evidence if they want. Rotkin has continued to say, well, it's only these protesters that are getting arrested. It's only these protesters who are being harassed. Elsewhere in the city, folks who know how to camp can hide out and do what they want, pretty much. And he's seen some of their camps. He's gone up there, he's seen their faraway camps, and those folks are left alone. You know, all is well with those people. Well, that is not my experience, both from going to the courts, where, since I go to the arraignments that our protesters have, I find other people on the court calendars under 6.36.010, which is the anti-homeless sleeping ban. And usually there's at least two or three people on the calendar, always one who is not part of the protest, picked up on a warrant for camping, which is usually part of a bunch of other charges, but there it is, it's still there, this sleeping charge. Additionally, we get reports. I got a report a week ago of a man whose backpack was stolen by police who found him sleeping and gave him a sleeping ticket, and the man showed me the sleeping ticket, and there was no receipt for the backpack. It was simply taken. Then, three or four days ago, a report was passed on to me from the vigil of a man whose backpack was not taken, but whose blanket was taken, and this was in a public drunkenness charge, and he was actually given a receipt for the blanket. And apparently the man showed that to the protest demonstration folks, and they passed on the word to me. So Rotkin is wrong. People are continuing to suffer harassment throughout the city. I mean, how could it be otherwise when there are 500 to 1,500 homeless people who have to sleep? There are no public bathrooms at night, so they get to piss wherever they can and crap wherever they can. Rotkin will not even open up a bathroom for the protesters, and yet the main reason that there were meetings scheduled between Celia Scott, Catherine Byers, and the protesters every Monday at 11, and there's another one today, by the way, even as you listen to this tape, was to deal with that, the difficulty of how unsightly and unsanitary the demonstration was and how that could be best dealt with. We've succeeded in turning that into a different topic, the real topics in question, namely, how do we change the laws so that the protest won't be necessary. But Rotkin and the council doesn't seem to be interested in opening up new public bathrooms at night, though that was something we did bring up and asked them, the council members, to put forward to seek to get staff input on. Indeed, that's what we're trying to do today. We're trying to get Celia Scott and Catherine Byers at this 11 o'clock meeting to actually get the city staff to start investigating real possible changes in the sleeping ban, what has been successfully done in Miami under federal court order, under the Pottinger decision, what was successfully done in Santa Barbara in 1986 until it was crushed by a reactionary judge in 1989 when the sleeping provision of the camping ban down there was eliminated. And we need to see some concrete steps taken by the city to begin to investigate this, and we need concrete steps by those so-called liberals, Byers and Scott, who say they support us, and yet have been in the past extremely timid, and now possibly maybe taking some tentative steps to actually bring the issue into public view. You know, you can't win until you try, and you may have to lose a couple of times until you win.
But Byers and Scott so far have not wanted to do anything until they're assured their four votes. Kennedy continues to tell reporters like a beggar backer Becky Johnson that he still opposes the sleeping ban. Now, there are those who say, you look at Byers and say, you have three votes, why not go for the fourth? And she kind of shakes her head nervously, indicating she may feel that Kennedy is no longer a firm vote. Well, for those of you who are interested, there is a city council meeting on Tuesday, May 14th. That's going to see the return of the second reading of the ordinance that bans selling jewelry or non-commercial sales down on the wharf and along the Lighthouse Drive and so forth. I think this is a discriminatory ordinance where there is no other area for those who need to sell their wares or to trade their wares for donations. There's already an existing ordinance of this kind, I understand, downtown on Pacific Avenue, and we see what the police do with that, running around harassing people and at the merchant's behest. We have a situation where something like Berkeley exists, where there are actually stalls can be put out by people who want to sell on the streets, or there are areas where people who want to and need to legitimately exchange their crafts for the necessities of life can do so without paying enormous taxes and securing ridiculously involved licenses. That actually brings business to town. I mean, this is the irony of it. These laws that they're trying to run homeless people out or trying to destroy the color and diversity that are going to supposedly turn things into a great money-making machine like Carmel or Capitola are actually having the opposite effect. The community survives and thrives on diversity. So, I don't know. I guess there's some who would dispute that with me. They'd say business is up, the downtown ordinances are working, sit on the sidewalk, go to jail, that's a great moneymaker. I don't think so, and I think it's going to continue to be a flashpoint. These hosts who are newly expanded from 4 to 5, the city council quietly pushed through their appropriation, the businesses who don't want to pay these assessments are being forced to, essentially by court order. Margaret Marr, a business person downtown, an attorney with a legal business downtown, was forced to do this even though she didn't want to do it. She sued them and so far has not been successful in resisting this compulsory assessment to support the hosts and these progressive downtown practices. And the hosts are still, as far as I know, carrying, at least one of them, pepper gas, gas which the ACLU claims is responsible for over 30 deaths since 1993. Gas which has been banned by the district attorney in San Francisco, although the police department, a week or two ago, said, oh, it's fine for San Francisco police. The police commission said, go ahead, just train your people better. Well, I'd like to see the hosts here in Santa Cruz trained in mediation skills. I'd like to see that whole process that was miraculously applied to the drummer's situation applied to the hosts. You may remember that the drummers were facing a drum after 8 o'clock, before 10 in the morning, go-to-jail law, which was the result of problems downtown where drummers were drumming too late and too inconsiderately near the residential areas where older folks were, and out on Lighthouse Drive as well, where the Pelham neighbors were complaining. And the Parks and Rec then initiated a draconian ordinance which said you can get one permit a month for 4 hours, period. Otherwise, you can't drum at Its Beach and that area. Drummers are getting together to try to promulgate a voluntary code, come to some understandings about how drumming should be done and how folks can approach them so that they are having problems sleeping, they can get that issue out, which I think is really commendable. It's along the lines of the Street Performers Guidelines, which Tom Noddy, Jan Luby, and others back in the early 80s were able to successfully substitute for a series of oppressive laws that the merchants and some members of the city council wanted to pass at that time. Ironically, then, the city council was much more conservative. Now we have a bunch of liberals on the council, and they give us the model for oppressive legislation in California, the downtown ordinances. We have the worst, or one of the worst, sleeping bans in California, barring sleeping not only in public spaces, but on most private spaces, almost any private building that isn't a domicile. For instance, if you fall asleep in a restaurant, theater, church, believe it or not, it's illegal. And there have been cases in each of these instances of citations being issued for these things. Not recently, admittedly, but within the last decade.
And you never know when these clowns or when the police are going to make a decision to do that. And the fact of the matter is, as we know, there's somewhere between 500 and 1,500 homeless people in the city who have no legal place to be and have to hide. And you read stories of rape in the papers. A woman was raped, I guess, what, 3 or 4 days ago, and a small story showed up in the Sentinel under the bridge. Would that have happened if there, for example, were a campground or several campgrounds or legal camping areas for people to be where they could feel safely and not have to hide out? Maybe it would have happened anyway. Maybe it wouldn't have. But the fact is that in terms of overall violence, Michael Rodkin's falsehoods, to the contrary, notwithstanding, the River Street, Coral Street open-air shelter, the campground for the last 2 years in 94 and 95, had much less violence and abusive behavior than, let's say, people were suffering when they were isolated and forced to hide. That was my understanding through numerous interviews with people out there. And, of course, when it served Rodkin's purposes, when it served the Citizens Committee for the Homeless's purposes to close it down, they closed it anyway and just broke their word to the campers that they'd made, a point I've often brought up on the station. Community House, that's the set of 10 trailers, the Trailers Not Trolls project that's going up on the bones of the campground out there at Highway 1 and Highway 9, is coming up for discussion for folks who are interested on May 14th. That's Tuesday, that's tomorrow morning, at 8:15 in the morning, at the Social Services Program Subcommittee. And they sent me one of their agendas. They're in the Mayor and City Manager's Conference Room, Room 10, at City Hall. That's the conference room that we're actually going to be meeting in today, probably almost about the time you hear this tape, talking to Celia Scott and Catherine Byers on how to get the City Council off of zero on the issue of the camping ban, the sleeping ban. They're going to, the Rodkin, Kennedy, and Yokoyama, who are the three council members on this Social Services Subcommittee, will be meeting tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning, and on their agenda is only one item, Citizens Committee for the Homeless Representative regarding Community House. What they want, what the CCH wants, is more money for its trailer project. More money for its $617 a month, drug and alcohol free, but planted in the middle of a drug and alcohol region, right next to all the homeless services, which everybody uses. And then they're going to fence that sucker off and have security and have fences and have no private phones and have drug tests. You know, it's not that one would oppose halfway houses and these programs generally, but when they are being run by people who have lied to the homeless people, broken their word regarding the campground, people who have excluded homeless activists from their meetings under pain of arrest, people who are essentially rounding up money for their projects and are the monopoly service provider in the city here, and I really have to account to nobody, because these people they're talking to on the city council are going to give them a blank check. Have already. They reject any criticism. Even Celia Scott, the most liberal member, she herself was a board member of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless for the last 6 years, and she has had no criticism of them. Not a word. No criticism. Similarly, when you listen to Mike Rodkin or read his recent written material, for example, this letter I mentioned to you earlier, the City on a Hill Press letter, he writes, "So why has Robert Norris singled out the city of Santa Cruz and its mayor and council for attack as anti-homeless? Simply because it's a city where people take concern for the homeless seriously. We spend more per capita on homeless programs than any city in the country. Although we provide inadequate shelter space in the summer in Santa Cruz, we do provide more shelter than most communities in the summer, and we have empty shelter spaces in the winter months here." Of course, he doesn't say why they have empty shelter spaces, because people do not want to go into a crowded armory where they're likely to suffer if one person coughs, everybody gets sick. Or they don't want to be herded into lines at 4 or 5 in the evening and dumped out in the early hours of the morning, missing chances to attend evening events, missing chances to finish up work, and so forth. "We are currently seeking a way to expand our summer shelter space. I'm not sure how they're doing that. Maybe by praying. I haven't seen any action going on around that. The police are more respectful of the rights of everyone, homeless included, in this town than most places." Well, they're more respectful than the San Francisco police. That certainly can be said. I don't know if they're more respectful than the Watsonville police, where there's a lot of camping allowed in spite of a nasty ordinance passed in 1987, modeled after Santa Cruz's.
hard work on the part of public officials, myself included, this is Michael Rotkin again, and selfless individuals who provide real services to the poor and homeless have persuaded the majority of our community that providing services to the poor is the right thing to do. It has taken many years of door-to-door work, public speaking and writing, and discussions with community groups to overcome the prejudice that exists against the homeless in every community in this country. Again, he's tooting the horn of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, the group that that he supports somewhat unthinkingly and somewhat uncritically. And the problem is that without any critical examination of the problems that have arisen last fall when the Citizens Committee was going to press through its community house project on the ruins of the campground come hell or high water, homeless people protested necessarily because accommodations for 20 to 40 is obviously a great step down from accommodations to 150 to 250, which is what you had out there before. And by accommodations, we're talking about emergency shelter, a legal place to sleep. And Rotkin, of course, hasn't championed opening up the Poganip, hasn't championed opening up any kind of public parks, hasn't championed opening up zones of the city, hasn't supported it. All he's done is attack those who have made those suggestions, who have pressed those demands, and support the arrest and harassment of those outside City Hall who are sleeping there because of his negligence, because of his callousness, because of his refusal to recognize the basic human rights issue, and perhaps because of his political opportunism. After all, we do have an election coming up here in November. I don't know whether he's running or not. He certainly hasn't said he's not running. This would be his fourth, count 'em, fourth term. And, you know, here's a man who originally supported making the sleeping ban a misdemeanor crime if you sleep twice in 48 hours. Here's a man who is just clear on this issue in terms of the fact that he will not budge. Now, frankly, I think he will budge. I think that if one more council member comes in line on this, or if Kennedy made a strong statement about this publicly and started pressing the issue publicly, Rotkin or Yokoyama would quickly begin to reconsider. So while I look at the sleeping demonstration that's gone on for 75 days, and frankly hasn't grown much bigger, although it's grown a little bigger. Last night when I was out there, there were, oh gosh, I don't know, 10 or 15 people there, and I'd say 5 or 6 people were laid out sleeping, ready to get their sleeping tickets if they had to. So it's continuing. It's continuing. It's going on night after night. And it's true it's not being joined by great numbers of homeless people. They don't want to get tickets. You know, nobody does. That's the point of the demonstration, eventually not to get tickets. But sometimes you've got to risk a little in order to get a lot. And, well, that's what people who are involved in these demonstrations think. A number of events are coming up in the next few days, and even today there's a budget meeting of the City Council at 5 o'clock today, continuing the budgetary discussions at City Council Chambers. I believe that's at 5 at 809 Center Street. I would encourage people from the sleep out to wander into that and suggest that maybe they could, you know, plunk down a little of that money for a campground. That would be a nice idea so that they could stop police expenses for ticketing and arresting homeless people and deal with the issue of legal places to sleep. At the same time, right across the way in the city manager's conference room, which so also meeting at the same time is the Citizens Police Review Board at 5 o'clock on Monday, May 13th. They're meeting in the City Manager Conference Room, which is where you go if you want to find the mayor. Go look for the mayor's office, and the conference room is right next to it. It's right close to the drinking fountain, which is near the bathrooms, which are near the City Council Chambers, if that tells you anything. And that's, again, CPRB, Citizens Police Review Board at 5. People are continuing to file complaints regarding police misconduct. There was some suggestion of filing a complaint against the Parks and Rec employee who has been watering the lawns and sometimes watering the demonstrators and calling the cops on circumstances where demonstrators are lying on the grass under the theory that a demonstrator lying on the grass is sort of an obscenity to see, just as a demonstration is an eyesore and, you know, oh, it hurts the grass. Well, there's no, the law is regarding this issue, if it is not signed, posted, keep out the grass, and you don't have to keep out the grass.
So unless they want to turn these into ornamental Japanese gardens, then it has to accommodate everybody. And if the city wants to refuse to recognize the rights of people to sleep at night, and indeed the rights of people to use public facilities at night, then what they're going to end up with, people sleeping and piles of shit. I mean, let's get real here, folks. That's the reality of it. You can belly and moan all you want. You can whine and complain all you want. You can be as bigoted as you want on the issue, but it doesn't change the human realities of the situation. Now, I'm not on the best of terms with the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, but I still have occasional contact with folks who are indeed involved with that program. And here we have an interview with Ron Howard, who's the operations manager of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, I should say the RUMP program, the little teeny remaining program that gives, I guess, space to, it's either 26 or 52 or people, something like that, at night. Spaces that are pretty much taken up. You can't really qualify by walking over there and standing usually there. I think you have to book them in advance. Let's hear what Ron has to say.
It's about 15 to 2 on May 3rd, 1996. I'm here on the corner of Pacific and Church talking to
Ron Howard.
Ron, you're biking through town here, but when you're not biking, you're often working for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program.
Correct.
So how's everything going with that program?
Well, as you know, we go into a reduced mode in the summertime. The needs aren't as great or as pressing for our homeless population as they are in the winter. We only handle 28 people in-house in Santa Cruz and 14 people in Watsonville. And as you know, both the armories have been closed, and there is some doubt and or concern with our population of whether they're going to be available to us next year or not. That's at the state level, and you know, we need to petition the people in Sacramento to make sure that we have adequate housing for the people that need it in the seasons when we do have to have it. Of course, they just had the groundbreaking for the community house project.
I saw that in the paper, May 1st.
I was surprised you weren't there.
Well, you know, I was up at Stanford with a thing called the Stanford Homeless Action Coalition. They were concerned about the rights of the homeless rather than, let's say, removing the rights of the homeless, like the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which runs community house, in my opinion, did when they evicted the campers from Coral Street and instead set up this rather costly trailer project.
You know, this has caused some serious divisiveness among large fragments of our community, with the city, the county, and people that concern me most, the homeless themselves. As with yourself, Robert, I mean, you've been working with homeless issues for years. Sometimes it's so frustrating and so difficult to make even the smallest inroads or gains for the population that needs it the most.
Oh, yeah. Well, I understand this project is still awaiting a HUD grant, right?
That is my understanding.
And ultimately, this is what? It's a $600,000 a year upkeep project, which serves people who pay $617 a month, right?
I don't know what the numbers are, to tell you the truth. That
could be.
Seems right. I'd heard low end as little as 150 and then up to 600.
Once they get some kind of grant funding for it.
They're also talking about, though, instead of incorporating as many people as possible into the program, they want to start off very slowly and establish a stable population to begin with. And they're talking about bringing in only 5 people initially when they'll have a facility that can house as many as 45 people. So you tell me.
So I guess the projected date for opening it up is July, right?
They're saying July 1st. I think that's an unrealistic date. With the amount of progress that's taken place and with the permit process still ongoing, I think it's going to slip back.
Now, I also heard that at least one of the churches that was taking up the slack, the Garfield Park Church, was allowing people to park and to some extent even to illegally camp, has now told the people that can no longer, as of May 1st, the same date, sleep or camp in that area.
And Reverend Hasty, a wonderful man, has supported this for a long, long time, legally and illegally. Was loath to tell those folks that they couldn't do it anymore, but he was approached by
neighbors,
city, who had contacted the city and said, hey, look, we don't want the same thing happening up here that happened Coral Street, when I don't see any reason for fear. I mean, they're part on private property. They're the Reverend's responsibility, not the city's. But that's just a matter of, you know, the community peer pressure coming together and saying, hey, we don't want it.
So who in the city contacted the Reverend, do you know? What department or?
It was my understanding that it was the public relations people through the SCPD.
So they were preserving good relations with the neighbors, perhaps?
Exactly.
So how many people had been sleeping there, and how many people?
In the morning when I get there, Robert, there would be as many as 7 or 8 campers, 2 to 3 people per camper. And one morning I showed up there, and Squirrel had his tent set up in the lawn.
Excellent. Yeah, I've seen Squirrel around. Is Holy Cross still taking people sleeping outside, or?
You have to go through the administrative offices up there to clear it with them, but it is my understanding that they are allowing people to sleep overnight there.
And how many churches are actually a part of this program that allow you to?
Bye-bye.
Bye.
To park on the property and sleep there, on the church garage or church parking lot areas.
There are about 8 or 10 that allow people to, if they have a vehicle, to park it on the property, but they have to be gone by a certain time. And then, of course, there are days when they don't want them to do it, particularly like Saturday night when they have services, early Sunday morning, things like that. So, you know, that's just a Band-Aid, too.
So, and these, of course, are people who have vehicles, right? Not for people who are without vehicles.
The people without vehicles have gone back out into the woods.
What do you hear about camping tickets for those in the woods? Nothing, some, lots?
I've only heard of one since they closed the back 40. Yeah. And that gentleman,
I saw 3 on the court calendar 2 days ago.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Hmm. 2 for a Spanish fellow and then another for a... I wrote his name down.
Was that related to the shooting?
No, I don't think so. I think that they were just ordinary... They were camping tickets that came on a failure to appear. And the failure to appear was... they were also connected with some other minor charge, I think. And I see at least 4 or 5 camping tickets a week in the courts when I go in there. And I don't go in there every day, and I don't check the calendar every day, so...
Can I ask you a question that's a little disjointed here, Rob?
Sure.
We've had numerous conversations over the last couple of years. And you know and are aware that today was Paul Marceau's last day.
No, I wasn't actually.
He had submitted his retirement 2 weeks ago, and effective today, he is no longer executive director. How do you feel about that?
Well, who's the new executive director?
They're not going to fill his position.
Really? What's the significance
initially,
of that?
Well...
Does it give you more freedom as a worker yourself?
It's going to give me more latitude, yeah. But I'm not sure if I want it. And...
Well, I'll tell you, I'm sympathetic with Paul in many respects, and I also am very critical of him as well. You've heard me be critical of Paul. As an individual, he's a very well-spoken guy. He seems to have his heart in the right place. He's, as service providers go,
no worse than any of the others.
Probably no worse than any of the others. The problem that, of course, he had was he was an official or an appointed negotiator for the CCH. He made commitments and promises to the River Street, the Coal Street open-air shelter folks, and violated them. And then, of course, he was the executive officer who essentially enforced it by calling in the cops and closing down the campground. And in doing this, he got a significant black mark against him in my book. I mean, against everybody he evicted. I mean, it was wrong for him to do that. He did. And then when we tried to hold him accountable before the Citizens Committee, I think he initiated action. Paul Lee, of course, was also very much culpable in this situation as the executive director and as an individual who I think exercised a personal grudge against me to silence an issue that really he had a responsibility to respond to, which was the fact that promises that had been tape recorded had been made, and I said I wanted to play this tape for the executive, for the board, not the executive board, the ordinary board. And, of course, they stopped me, they shut me up, and next time I came to the meeting, they tried to have me arrested, called the cops twice for trespass. So, I am persuaded they erred in those matters. He also, Paul Marceau, I think, erred in, when I complained about this in a letter, his response was not to give the matter to a neutral third party, but to make a decision himself, to judge his own conduct, and to make a judgment about my requests. For example, that his meetings be tape recordable, as they have always been in the past, they be open to the media, that they be open to any member of the public that wants to come. And his response to that was essentially a series of sophisms, I thought, that had little to do with the substantive issues involved, and were personal attacks on me. So I'm disappointed how he responded to me in that situation.
Well, I really can't grudge you for that remark, because there were things that could have been handled differently, they could have been handled better, and unfortunately they weren't. And the resolution that came down affected a lot of people in a negative manner, and
Well, I mean, that's water under the bridge now. All we can do is just try and do it differently in the future, right?
I agree completely.
The reason I keep raising the issue is, you see, it's not simply the Citizens Committee that's to blame for this. It's the city, which backed up the Citizens Committee with police and city council muscle. It's the city which refuses to find a new campground area for homeless people. It's the county, which also has much more space to do much more with what they have if they wanted to. And so, in a way, the reason I keep raising the issue is because the problem that was created by the closing Coral Street is one that no one is addressing. And so it has to be continually raised again, I think.
I agree. And the city and county like to treat it as a seasonal kind of issue, it seems. My God, if you're homeless, you're homeless 356 days a year, regardless if it's 100 degrees outside or if it's 40 degrees and raining.
That's right.
You know, this is something that we need to address in an annual kind of sense instead of just when it gets cold and wet.
It's true. You've been homeless yourself?
Indeed I have. I was homeless for 3.5 years. Just recently got out of homeless, as a matter of fact, 6 months ago. And it's damn difficult to break the cycle. I mean, and once you do get it broken, if you don't work your butt off...
You step again, you are at the same fucking scene.
That's it, exactly.
Right. And I thought you'd introduce me to that woman immediately, but let's not even discuss that. So, I'll talk to you again, and thank you very much, Ron Howard. We'll have another conversation.
Enjoy day, sir.
Thank you.
And perhaps we can get more of an update from Ron on what's actually been going on now that we're 10 days further along, and it's May 13th. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, Bathropes, Piers, Broadsides. This is the recorded version, and hopefully you're going to be hearing me live again on Friday, and if not, perhaps you'll be hearing Beggarbacker Becky Johnson live on Friday. I will be in jail if that's the case, or near it. And hopefully everyone will send those cards and letters in, and we'll give you information on how to send in those large donations, cannabis brownies, and so forth. Speaking of cannabis, there is, of course, an ongoing controversy. The radio station, as you may know, had its problems with the Cannabis Collective. And there are still some problems outstanding between Ed Fry, who is the lessee who holds the lease for the building in which the Cannabis Collective folks are, also has a law office there, and the Cannabis Collective, and they are on rent strike because of Ed Fry's eviction notice to them. He has evicted them not because he disagrees with what they're doing, as I understand it from Ed, as far as they're providing marijuana to those who need it medically. But he is concerned with the actions of one of their number, a man named Neil, who I guess it was a week ago or so, I guess it was Monday night, maybe it was Sunday night, a week ago to Sunday, broke down the door of the Free Radio, and in the course of that activity assaulted three different people. At least that's the report of two of them, Phil Free and Bob Duran, and the third did call the police on Neil. And I was there when the police arrived. I didn't witness any of the actual breaking down of the door. Neil, for his part, claims that he himself admits he was intoxicated, admits he came back from Palomar on the Cinco de Mayo, that's when it was, intoxicated. He says he was assaulted on the way home by several folks on the mall who had sort of said he had closed down Free Radio because there had been some friction between Neil and Free Radio. Indeed, Free Radio had chosen to move, had announced it was going to move under pressure from the Cannabis Collective, both of whom at that time were in the same building. I don't think this is secret information anymore for those who are worried about it. It's a public information for a lot of us, and also an important public issue that's come up. Anyway, when Neil got back, there had been numerous complaints about the Free Radio from the Cannabis Collective, but complaints that had not really effectively reached the Free Radio Collective. No members of the Cannabis Collective ever attended one meeting of the Free Radio Collective in the course of all their complaints. They channeled their complaints through Ed Fry and other people. It never really, there were concerns about noise and concerns about friction between members of the Cannabis Collective and the Radio Collective. There were concerns mainly about after December, when Fred Psyche moved into the building. He was kind of shepherding the Cannabis Collective program. He's an older man who had recently had a stroke,
and he needed quiet around the house, and Canada and the free radio people were, some of them were not respecting that or not aware of that, and it wasn't effectively communicated. And so eventually there was a big blow up and a unilateral threat that everybody had to leave, or the statement was that security would remove the free radio, even though the Cannabis Collective was not in any way the leaseholder of the building. Both Free Radio and the Cannabis Collective were leasee or subleasees, as I understand, sublessees from Ed Fry. Though indeed, the Cannabis Collective pointed out it paid the lion's share of the rent and still does, and that's the power that it's using in this rent strike, which they originally threatened to do if Free Radio didn't leave, which it did. But now they're threatening to do because Ed Fry has evicted, initially evicted, I believe, Neil, the man who broke down the door, claiming it was the second such violent incident in a over a period of time, and that Neil had promised not to repeat that incident, and he'd done it again. I think Ed is concerned that this is an alcohol-related problem, whereas Neil's friends claim that he has no alcohol problem any more than any other person. It's a big can of worms, and I was trying to mediate this over the weekend to try to get both sides together, and hopefully they will get together, although I haven't heard that they are getting together around this issue. Instead, I'd asked Free Radio to lay off attacks on Neil, per se, because he apparently was physically assaulted himself down on the mall. And what we need here is some kind of meeting of the minds. We need some kind of understanding that everybody, number of people have been injured, and we want to stop this kind of stuff from escalating into some kind of petty gang war here, which is ridiculous. That's my position. There's also a lot of concerns about the Cannabis Club I heard raised at the Free Radio meeting last night, namely that the Cannabis Club sells its marijuana at street prices instead of giving it away. This is an inappropriate practice for a club that wants to really see the spreading of marijuana, and that there's so many growers in the area that it should be doable without cost, as some of the speakers claimed had been the case before the current management of the Cannabis Club came in. Now, I hope to interview the Cannabis Club on this issue. I don't wish to state any particular position myself. I regard myself as friends.